Shrink Wrap Radio number 611. Charles Tauber, MD, on training volunteers to deal with the traumas of war.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today's episode is brought to you by Calm, the number one app for meditation, sleep, and relaxation. My guest today is Dr. Charles Tauber, a passionate activist who has worked with many causes ranging from social justice to nonviolent civil disobedience for civil rights to support for refugees and asylum seekers. Currently, he's stationed in Croatia as CEO of the Coalition for Work with Psychotrauma and Peace. For more information about Charles Tauber, MD, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Charles Tauber, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure. My great pleasure, in fact.
Yeah, wonderful. I'm glad you feel that way. Actually, I'm remembering that you reached out to me after hearing me talk about an episode on a podcast called The Science of Psychotherapy, in which I talked about an episode. And then I saw who you were, the work that you were doing, and I said, of course I want to talk to you. Of course I want to have you on our podcast because it sounds so important. You're a CEO of something called the Coalition for Work with Psychotrauma and Peace. And that really caught my eye. And you're in Croatia right now, where it's about 9 o'clock. Yeah. 9 o'clock in the evening. Yeah. But before we get into that, I was struck by that as a young man, you volunteered extensively in a number of movements of social conscience kinds of movements. Environmental and peace movements, nonviolent civil disobedience for civil rights, and so on. So what's the driving force in your personality, if I may ask, that's led to your lifelong activism?
Well, first of all, my parents were big activists. I grew up in a refugee family in a refugee neighborhood in New York City.
Refugees from where? Were they refugees?
Eastern Europe. They were, okay. In fact, from Eastern Europe. So it's a crazy kind of a journey that I've made. In fact, it's a backward journey to that of my parents and my family. Would you believe in 1977, when I left the United States to go to medical school in Antwerp and later in Groningen in the Netherlands, I was actually a tour guide on Ellis Island. So there are some big ironies there. My dad was a labor organizer in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And he got beat up by a lot of police, and there were all kinds of stories in the family about that. He died in 1957, and he was a real example. He was apparently very hard-headed and took very courageous stands for human rights and all the rest of it. My mother was a teacher in a high school in New York City, multi-ethnic high school, always stood up for people. I had two aunts, my mother's sisters, who were mediators. Actually, they were both also high school teachers, but they were also mediators during the riots in the schools in the 60s in New York. And so it kind of came, you know, I would almost say in my genes. I started working with the Sierra Club in 1966 as a volunteer in New York when I was 13 years old. Worked in the environmental movement, was on lots of peace marches, did a little bit of civil disobedience in terms of environmental and peace work. Was involved in the first actions of Greenpeace in the early 70s when I was in university, when I was at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. driving up to Vancouver, British Columbia, and then a friend of mine, we were living together in a student house, had a ham radio at that time.
And we ham radio. I'm a ham radio operator, though inactive at this point. I started when I was about 12 or something like that, and it was all Morse code for me at that time, at least when I first got into it. And then later, I was able to get onto 2 meters with a used home-built thing that I bought from somebody. And then when I went away to college, my parents got rid of all that stuff. I was so upset. So about 10, 15 years ago, I decided to get back, maybe 20, I've lost track of time. I decided to get back into it. And I think as a kid, I got as far as general class. And then when I came back to it later as an adult, who could afford to buy some equipment, by the way, I moved quickly through the licenses and made it to the extra class license. Worked a whole bunch of countries, and then got bored with it. It can get to be very repetitive, as you know. The conversations, very minimal.
Well, what was happening then, and I think this was 71 or 72. My friend had an antenna, something like 10 feet. So what? 2.5-3 meters on top of our house, and we were receiving those first broadcasts from the boat. I forget the name of it, but it was one of Greenpeace's first actions to stop the Amchitka blast, and we were feeding that into the alternative radio network from Portland and into the States, and we were in fact in conversation in contact with Senator Wayne Morse, if you remember him.
I remember the name, yeah.
Morse was one of the only people to vote against the Tonkin Gulf resolution. Mm-hmm. So, and then when I got out of Reed in 77, I decided that I was going to combine the studies. I wanted to work the science, but I also wanted to work the people. And I couldn't get in the States because Reed's grading system was too high. And so I ended up for a year and a half in Antwerp, Belgium, and then went up to Groningen, which is in the northeastern part of the Netherlands. When I worked in psychiatry as a student assistant there, and when I got out of medical school, there was a group run jointly by Amnesty International and the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, which was known as the Medical Examination Group. That group was supporting the requests of asylum seekers and refugees for asylum, and supporting people where other doctors were not willing to do so because, you know, working with asylum seekers and refugees is very hard work. It takes a lot of effort, first of all, to gain trust. Also, they have very difficult both physical and psychological problems. And we were spending a lot of time dealing with that.
Yeah, let me just cut in. We're going to get into all of this as we go along. I'm wondering, did you a rotation through psychiatry. Did you end up becoming a psychiatrist or some other specialty?
No, I'm a general physician.
Okay.
But in the course of years, I would say most of my work has been with psychiatry and psychology.
Yeah, interesting. It would seem that from the name of the organization and so on. And
We do some physical work because obviously the physical consequences of what people have been through, both war victims and asylum seekers and refugees, they have huge psychological consequences. And when people hold in their feelings, which many people do for a lot of reasons. For men particularly, it's a question of shame and, you know, a lot of cultural stuff, especially here.
Yeah, exactly.
In traditional countries. But eventually it comes out one way or another. And it comes out a lot of times through the body. So you'll see, for example, heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, thyroid problems, stomach problems of all sorts. More or less, you name it, you see it. And those are very serious problems. They're real diseases. They're not just psychosomatic or in the head. A lot of people feel those pains. So we have to be able to deal with that. And another side of that is that people have been tortured. And this may sound like a very bad joke, but the profession of torturer is one of the most creative in the world. Yuck. Unfortunately.
Yeah, yuck. One of the words in the title of your organization is that you work with psychotrauma. And why do you call it psychotrauma rather than, say, trauma? What are you getting at there?
There's no reason we couldn't call it trauma.
Okay. One of the things I was wondering around that is, it seems, you know, I've done a lot of interviews where we were talking about trauma, and one of the things that I've become aware of is that there's been a kind of definitional creep, maybe you might describe it, where some of my guests have kind of implied that we're all traumatized, that nobody gets through life without being traumatized. Yet it seems to me like you're talking about something that is more intense.
Yes and no. And we don't use the term PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. We use the term post-traumatic stress reactions, plural.
Why? Because
these are very natural reactions that every human being who is at any rate halfway sane would have.
Yeah, and I gather you don't want to stigmatize them by calling it a disorder.
That's indeed another problem. People, especially in traditional societies, the one here, the Arab societies, the African societies, it's very stigmatized to be quote-unquote crazy or quote-unquote mad. People aren't mad. In fact, they would be sick. People aren't sick. In fact, we would argue that if they didn't have these reactions, and when they repress these reactions, they are sick.
Yeah, right. Now, you're headquartered, as we mentioned, in Croatia, but also you have offices, I gather, or facilities in Serbia and Bosnia-Herzegovina. How did that come about?
We don't have facilities there
okay.
yet. We're working on an office in Belgrade. We would like to have an office in Belgrade because, despite what everybody is saying, the Balkan route is not closed. People are still coming up from Greece and Macedonia and Bulgaria, and they're coming into Serbia, and they're coming into Bosnia-Herzegovina. And another problem when they're coming through the Balkans is, make no illusions, the consequences of the 1991 to 1995 wars, and in fact the bombing of Serbia in 1999, those consequences still exist. They have not been dealt with. Mm-hmm. And so the people they're coming into, they're traumatized, and so they're getting these traumas of the migrants, or the people on the move, as we prefer to call them, even more so. So that's compounding the issues.
So they're being forced to get out of whatever country they came up in to find another home or refuge somewhere, and the place that they're coming to is a place that's already traumatized.
Exactly.
Wow. Exactly. So, and you're in the middle of that.
We're absolutely in the middle of it. This town, Vukovar, in 1991 was completely destroyed. When I came here in June 1995, barely a bit. I don't think there was a building that was whole. There were plants that were growing out of it. All the buildings were mud. There are still some landmarks around here. You have to still be a little bit careful where you walk.
Wow, landmines.
And it was 25 years ago, but still.
Yeah. Now, you're there doing good, wanting to do good. I wonder, are you ever suspected, and have there ever been threats to you, physical threats?
Threats, not so much, but certainly we're thought of as spies sometimes. We work on both sides, and people don't like that. So that can be a problem. We work with anybody who comes to our door, irrespective of, ethnicity, religion, national origin, color, sexual orientation, age, and so on and so forth. We work with anybody.
When you say you work on both sides, what are the both sides?
Sorry. In Vukovar, it's primarily Serb and Croat. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, it would be also what would be called Bosniak, which would be Muslim, roughly.
Okay.
You have to remember that Vukovar is an extraordinary city, really. It's 8,000 years old. 8,000.
8,000 years old, wow.
One of the first calendars in Europe. Recently, I think about a year ago, there was a calendar that was older that was discovered in Scotland. But before that, it was known as where the first calendar in Europe came from.
Mm-hmm.
The so-called Vucadol culture. Extraordinary place. Before the Second World War, there were something like, and before these wars of 91-95, there were something like 25 or more different ethnicities here. You don't find anybody, if you dig a little bit, you don't find any person who is pure, as they said during the 1991 to 1995 years. It doesn't exist.
They were trying to do a sort of racial purification, right? Or religious purification.
That's right.
Yeah. And yet, it doesn't really exist.
No, it doesn't really exist. And as far as that's concerned, the schools are still segregated. There are still Serb and Croat programs.
Mm-hmm.
The cafes are still more or less segregated.
Really?
So, you know where people are. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Are you careful about what cafe you go to?
I'm not at all. But everybody knows me around here.
Okay.
I've been around so long, so, and I'm this crazy foreigner, so okay. We're sort of part of the woodwork here.
What are the other hot spots in the world where you have some kind of work going on that you're involved in?
Well, we're trying, let me put it that way.
Okay.
We have a very good friend in South Africa, whom I speak to every week, who himself is from the DR Congo, from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We'd like to work more in the Congo. We have connections with Toronto, and I'm part of the board of an organization called Interchange for Peace, which is based in Toronto, which has a number of different nationalities. There's a guy there from Uganda who's on our board. There are people from Kenya there. We just got a request from Myanmar, which we and I'd be itching to do that. We'd like to work in Palestine, Israel-Palestine. There are a lot of places we'd like to work. We do a lot of work online. We're also putting our educational program. One of the things we do, one of our main pieces of work, is giving courses. We train what are known as barefoot therapists or peer support. There are, in The Lancet in 2007, there was a series of articles that said that 90%, over 90% of the people who need to be getting psychological assistance are not for the concentration of those people in conflict and post-conflict areas. Now, that situation hasn't changed in the intervening 10 or 11 years. Now, you can't possibly train enough psychologists or psychiatrists to deal with those kinds of situations. Furthermore, experts sit a little bit on a pedestal. So the whole idea that we have is to train people at the grassroots level.
I really want to go into this in more depth because it's something I'm very interested in.
It's very important.
Yeah, let's come back to that right now. If we can, I want to take a break to speak about today's sponsor, which is an app called Calm, and it's the number one app for sleep, meditation, and relaxation. And it's perfect sponsor for this show. This is the first time I've mentioned it on the show, and it's perfect because I've interviewed so many people who are involved in meditation, either in the science of it, the medical aspects of it, the spiritual aspects of it, and the psychological aspects of meditation. And you're working for peace in the world, which is kind of external peace, and we could think of this as a tool for internal peace. What do you think? Have you been involved with meditation yourself?
Absolutely, and we recommend it. We recommend breathing. We recommend all kinds of meditation. We think it's a very, very good way of calming down rather than using drugs. We're pretty much against drugs.
Yeah.
Or a lot of drugs, particularly stuff like benzodiazepines and the weird and wonderful combinations that they prescribe here. Meditation, mindfulness, those sorts of approaches are much, much better.
Yeah, mindfulness, which is one of the components of my sponsor, Calm, they've got different modules that people can choose between. They actually have created a very kind of, I almost want to say, vast collection of modules to fit whatever somebody's working on. And mindfulness, you can hardly pick up any book on psychotherapy today or psychology that doesn't have a chapter on mindfulness. It's just really amazing how big it's become. And for a long time, meditation was associated with Buddhism and still is, but it was sort of the impact of Jon Kabat-Zinn, who created his 8-week mindfulness program and separated it from the religious, spiritual, historical connotations to westernize it. And that's just found application in so many different places. And I've had the privilege of interviewing Richie Davidson, who did a lot of work on imaging, brain imaging with Buddhist monks, and who's been on the platform with the Dalai Lama, for example.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I kind of I dived into Calm myself, and for a kind of stress reduction, they've got a module on anxiety, and as I have gotten older, I'm planning a trip back east from California back to New York and Boston and New Hampshire. And I'm finding I'm uptight about that. Travel used to be a lot easier. Now it seems like there's so many things to be concerned about. And so I've been working on a 7-day module that they have, 7-day module on anxiety. And They're nice bite-sized modules. Like the they do a certain amount of teaching about anxiety as I close my eyes and I'm listening on my iPhone, and it's giving me, you know, some of the theory behind it and so on, as well as some silent time to let it all sink in. And so I'm finding that to be a very useful practice. Do you have trouble sleeping?
I'm generally so tired by the end of it.
Just bang, you just fall asleep. Because I know a lot of people. A lot of people struggle with sleeping, and they've got a module on that. They even have sleepy time stories, where I haven't had a chance to check that out yet, but just because I generally can fall asleep easily myself. But, you know, I'm really excited to have them as a sponsor. They are the number one app for sleep, meditation, and relaxation. So you might say, well, who says they're the number one app? Well, they were Apple Computer anymore, but Apple named them the 2017 app of the year. So that's what that claim is based on. So I think this will have great appeal to my listeners, because I know many of my listeners are interested in topics like meditation. Some are longtime meditators. Some are like me. I've been, in some ways, I could say I've been a meditator for 30 or 40 years at least, except I've never developed a completely disciplined, all the time, every day practice. And so one of the ways in which Calm can be helpful is they give you a gentle reminder. You'll get a text gently reminding you that, hey, you might want to meditate today. And so I appreciate that. They even have a brand new meditation each day called the Daily Calm. So they have both a lot of these sort of structured meditations, as well as the open-ended ones. And on the open-ended ones, you can figure out how much time you want to spend on it. So all my listeners out there and viewers on YouTube, I want you to know that for a limited time, Shrink Wrap Radio listeners, viewers can get 25% off the Calm Premium subscription by going to calm.com/shrink. And that includes all of Calm's amazing content. So get started today, everybody, by going to calm.com/shrink. That's calm.com/shrink. So we were talking about the barefoot therapist, an idea that I find very intriguing, because, as you say, there aren't enough trained professionals to do this work, and not enough that would be willing to go to some of these places that you're talking about. So you said you referred to them as barefoot therapists, and there was another term that I didn't quite catch.
The language we use for what we call them varies with the country and varies with the region. We call them barefoot therapists, supportive counselors, peer supporters, whatever you like. The point is, these are people who have good hearts, who want to help other people, who maybe have some experience with other people, maybe don't, who maybe have a little bit of education, who maybe don't, but who want to learn. And we have, since I started doing all of this in 1988, we've developed a program which we now call Pragmatic Empowerment Training. Now, if you look on our website, www.cwwpp.org, you'll see the outlines of it. And we're writing, at the moment, we're in the process of writing self-paced online courses. But we've been doing it for, 30 years now?
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess originally it must have been in person, and now you're migrating it to online?
We do both. We do a combination of both, online and on-site. We do it in person. In person, it's a very dynamic technique. It's participant-led. It's based on, for those of your listeners who know a little bit of psychology, it's based on Carl Rogers' participatory education.
Okay.
So we have a curriculum. The curriculum consists of an introduction to work with people, self-care, interpersonal and group communication, basic psychology and counseling with a concentration on trauma, nonviolent conflict transformation, civil society, integration, and human rights. But the heart of it is not only in the content, it's in the technique. Because people decide themselves what order they take that in, and there's a lot more discussion and practice than there is lecture. So, and that leads to psychological supervision for people who are working with other people, but it also leads to therapy by another name, because in those groups, people can talk about just about anything. They gain trust within the PET groups and so on. We started with people who were working with asylum seekers back in the Netherlands. And they were saying to us, hey, we're not getting education. We're not getting psychological supervision. Can you help? And so we kind of shut up and listened to them, and we developed the program. We didn't exist at that point, but I did at that point. And when we got here, we found that it was very good for working with war victims. And it's very good for working with other people. It also has the advantage that you don't actually have to go there, that you create a snowball effect, a pyramid effect, that if you train some trainers, they in turn can go into their own communities and train other people, and they can work with other people. We're trying to get to the grassroots level. So go into villages, work with asylum seekers themselves, work with war victims themselves, and let them do the work further. And that works. We found that that works very well.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in experiential education. And
absolutely.
When I was in graduate school, there was a movement known as there was T groups and encounter groups, and an approach that was referred to as laboratory learning, and that influenced my own whole career. Everything that you're saying really makes a lot of sense to me in terms of the values that you're representing there.
We think it's very important because, as I mentioned before the break, you know, a lot of parts of the world here, lots of parts of Africa, lots of parts of Asia, people simply aren't getting the help they need. And a lot of that help is simply listening. A lot of it is simply letting somebody talk about what he or she has been through, getting the feelings out. Mm-hmm. And that's crucial.
Mm-hmm.
And facilitating that and knowing a little bit more than that, knowing how, not only how to do it, but what's going on with it, is extremely important for healing. It's extremely important for the peace-building process as well, because one of the things, for example, that you see here is, and one of the things that I maintain, is that a lot of the reason for the wars in the former Yugoslavia, forgive that term, let's say Croatia, Serbia, Bosnia, etc., was that the trauma was not processed. Now, that's another thing that people like John Paul Lederach from Eastern Mennonite University, now I think he's at Notre Dame, talk about in terms of the Middle East as well. There's also this whole business of transgenerational transmission of trauma, which some people think now has an epigenetic component as well. And so the traumas are the traumas and the negative narratives are transmitted from generation to generation.
Yeah.
And if you don't pick that up early, people like Vomik Volkan from the University of Virginia have said, and John Burton from Australia, talk about this going on for hundreds and even thousands of years. So it's very important to deal with it. We're certainly seeing it here among the kids in Vukovar, among the children and young people here. When you talk about it, what's happening in the schools, et cetera, it's staggering. And we know, and because it's not being dealt with, and because we're letting the politicians control some of this ethnic rhetoric, we know that people are preparing for the next wars.
Wow. Do you have to... I don't know if any of your work is being supported by grants. I would guess that maybe it's something like that, and that they might require...
We don't have enough, obviously.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, have you had to demonstrate the efficacy of your work somehow, and how do you do that?
Now you're coming to a really key question. How do you demonstrate?
Right.
How do you demonstrate long-term effects? Donors, governments, people like that want to see results within a month, within 6 months, within a year. You can't do this. How do you demonstrate that you're preventing something? This is very frustrating for us. Donors are not into mental health. Donors are absolutely not into mental health. They also think that in the Balkans and everywhere else, it's finished. We've had potential donors, I should say, because they haven't given us money, have said that this stuff is irrelevant or peripheral. We're extremely frustrated by that, and we always come up short every year. We're always short of money. The people out in the field know that what we're doing is right. I've had people come up to me on the street here in Vukovar and in other places where we worked, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, in Serbia, other places, where they've said, hey, you know that stuff you did 10 years ago? Well, now I'm seeing what you're talking about. But it takes long periods of time.
Yeah.
I went on an assessment trip to Liberia in, 2009, beginning of 2009. And some of the people there said to us, hey, don't come here unless you're going to be here for at least 10 or 15 years. This is the point that you have to have a long-term presence. And that's very difficult to achieve.
Yeah.
We've had one guy who's been a great donor. Unfortunately, he's a bit older now, and he will stop at the end of next year, so we're going to have some problems finding funding. But we really need to find some new donors. But that's what this stuff takes. You have to be there for a long term. You have to be patient. You have to be persistent. You have to listen constantly.
This sounds like potentially burnout work. How do you keep your...
How many times have my colleague and I gone through it? I mean, you know,
What keeps you going? What do you do to support yourself emotionally, psychologically, to hang in there?
You'll laugh, but I have a very good meal every day. I listen to music.
Uh-huh.
I listen to music sometimes the BBC, I hate to say it, but the, I don't know if you know it, but the BBC website, which has marvelous, marvelous stuff on it, bbc.co.uk. Their radio and their radio primarily, has everything but the kitchen sink on it. And, it's very good for me. I walk in the woods. Mm-hmm. Whatever else Ukavar is, it's a beautiful place. We're about 200 yards from the Danube River, and the restaurants where I eat are right on the Danube. It's gorgeous.
Wow.
Yeah. And so nature, meditation, as you were talking about,
mm-hmm.
Helps me a great deal. I talk to friends on Skype, Zoom, whatever.
Yeah.
Work itself, when I'm really working with people, when I'm teaching or when I'm doing therapy with people, it sounds crazy, but I'd rather work with 10 tortured people a day than do 10 minutes of administration or fundraising.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can understand that. Because, you know, the one is kind of abstracted from the real stuff of reality, and the other, you're intensely involved in something that's very, very real, very dynamic, and very important.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you have the feeling that you're involved with somebody's life.
Yes.
And that sustains me. You have the feeling... Or I have the feeling, and I know this is true of my colleague as well, that you can actually make a difference, even if you don't see it immediately. You know that just physically by sitting there, just physically by letting the person fume, by letting the person release everything that's in him or her, you know that that's creating a relief, and you know that you're doing something.
Mm-hmm. So you're letting them express themselves without judgment.
Absolutely without judgment.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Sometimes I'll say two words in an entire hour. You know, hello and goodbye.
Yeah.
And that's very important for people, particularly for highly traumatized people. Letting them cry, being non-judgmental, whatever they have done, telling them that they've done the best that they could at that particular moment, that's a favorite
mm-hmm.
phrase of
mine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That works. And that's what we teach people to do, too.
Yeah. You know, the world seems so fraught with conflict right now. So this is, I don't know if it's any different than the question that I just asked you about how you keep going. I mean, do you have a sense of hope for the world? And if so, how would you articulate that?
Ooh, that's a tough one. That's a really tough one.
Yeah.
We see what's going on everywhere. We see the senselessness of military spending, of destroying people for what we consider to be nothing. For what? For power? For money? To sell weapons? For one country or another? For one ruler or another, and I say that very nicely because I could get quite obscene about it. We see that's going on. We see the other side of it that we see, or that I see, because I get lots and lots of emails every day, is the enormous strides in knowledge, in the medical field, in science of all sorts. And to me, it's amazing. It's stuff that we couldn't have dreamed of. It's almost like science fiction.
Yeah, I get excited about that kind of thing, too. Yeah.
You can get very excited about it very quickly.
Yeah.
And we think that something that is almost continually going through my head is, if that money that is now being spent on arms and wars and all the rest of it were to be spent on medical research or on healing people and on doing the kind of work on education, my Lord, what kind of a world could this be? So that's my hope. That could get exciting. So that's my hope. Where I get my hope. But
it takes people like you to get us there, and hopefully, you know, and there.
I don't think that I'm too special. I'm just sort of a kind of a slob. A friend of mine from the UN long ago said, whenever you get over 40, and I think you and I are both over 40, said, when you get over 40, you're a member of Old Farts Anonymous. All fine. And so, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm definitely a member.
Yeah, so am I.
Yeah.
And, what little I can do, I do. But it isn't much. It's, as the Dutch would put it, you're of Dutch origin, I see, from your name.
Yeah.
They would say a drop on a glowing griddle, roughly translated.
Huh.
In the air. And that's the way I feel. A drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
You don't do much, but if you can help one person.
If you get enough drops, the bucket becomes very full and very heavy, right? So I think your drops are very important and encourage you to.
And by the way, if there are your listeners out there who are interested in cooperating with us and working with us in some way, wherever they are, we're very interested in hearing from
you. Do you have an email address that you'd like to put out there or mention way to get to your website again?
Sure. The website is www.cwwpp.org. And the email address is cwwpp.summer, like the English word summer, @gmail.com.
Okay.
cwwpp.summer@gmail.com. And that applies to people from any kind of vulnerable groups who would like to learn about this stuff. Most of the stuff we do is for free. As I say, we're always in a funding crisis. So if there's anybody out there who knows some donors who are sympathetic to this kind of stuff, we're very interested in hearing that too. But we try. We live from day to day, but what else can we do?
All right.
I've been doing this for 23 years, so.
Okay, well, Dr. Charles Tauber, I want to thank you for sharing this view of the wonderful work that you're doing, even though it may feel like just a drop. I think it's very important, and I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been my pleasure, Dave.
I'm so impressed by Dr. Tauber's passionate dedication to human rights and social justice. It's clear that he's driven by conscience and that this trajectory started early in his life, set by the examples of his refugee parents. There was a point in the interview when he was speaking about the generational aspect of trauma, where the stories of victimhood and injustice get passed down from parents to children and so on, with the effects showing up sometimes for hundreds of years. It makes me wonder if his own story might be seen as a positive example of generational transmission, that the good works of parents might similarly have a positive impact not only on their children, but also their children's children, and so on down the line. I'm not sure there's any evidence on this, but I'd like to think it's true because it would be a source of hope for the future and would inspire us to make sure we are inspiring our children by our positive acts. I hope you were able to hear Dr. Tauber clearly. As I listen back, the sound from his side doesn't sound as good as I hoped for. We're nearly on opposite sides of the planet, and so it's not surprising that there might be some decrement in the fidelity. I have no idea, for example, what sort of hosting he's able to get there in Croatia. Rather than focusing on the poor quality, however, we should be celebrating the miracle that such communication is possible at all. Also, I have to apologize for going down the ham radio rabbit hole as long as I did. I was just so excited to discover that he and I had that in common. And I suspect we have much more in common that there wasn't time to get into and that would have been off topic. Getting back to Dr. Tauber's dedication to his good works, I'm impressed when I stop to think about it that with his medical education, this New York City bred boy could be making good money in this country and living a very comfortable life. However, it's clear that's not where his values lay, and thank goodness for that. The humanitarian service he renders is much more important and impactful and reaches so many more people in real need. I was intrigued to learn that the model for his training of barefoot therapists is based on the work of Carl Rogers. If you've listened to these podcasts for any length of time, you will have heard me praise Carl Rogers as something of an unsung hero these days. I was privileged to share a dinner with Carl Rogers some years back. It was towards the end of his life. According to Wikipedia, in 2003, Rogers was found to be the sixth most eminent psychologist of the 20th century and second among clinicians only to Sigmund Freud. It was toward the end of his life that Rogers began to sponsor open dialogues between factions and troubled hotspots such as between Israelis and Palestinians, the Irish North and South, and blacks and whites in this country. Again, according to Wikipedia, toward the end of his life, Rogers came to that view himself that the central tenet of a Rogerian person-centered politics is that public life does not have to consist of an endless series of winner-take-all battles among sworn opponents. Rather, it can and should consist of an ongoing dialogue among all parties. Dr. Tauber and I continued our conversation after the recorder was turned off. One of the things he emphasized then was that he'd really like to hear from listeners who would be interested in joining or forming social networks to reach out to troubled crisis places in the world. So let me give you his email address one more time. It's cwwppsummer@gmail.com. Once again, cwwppsummer@gmail.com.
Hi there. This is Ingrid greeting you from Copenhagen, Denmark. I've pressed the now multicolored donate button because at any time, anywhere I choose, I can listen to the most interesting psychological deep wisdom podcasts. It is just like sunshine to a troubled mind. And now I feel wiser and more dangerous. European co-listeners, Shrink Wrap Radio, sailing to you from over there in a nice pace with friendly Captain David on board. All for free. I'm only happy to set the sails.
Thank you, Ingrid from Copenhagen. I so appreciate your message and your donation. I sure hope others will follow suit, as you've suggested and demonstrated. We now have two new donors since the last podcast, and they are Kimberly Tangen, PhD, and Jill Albritton. Thank you, Kimberly and Jill. Once again, I want to thank today's sponsor, Calm.com, where you can get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/shrink. Now, you might be wondering why I solicit donations and also carry occasional ads like this one for Calm.com. The truth is that as grateful as I am for both these income sources, they don't make this podcast self-supporting. It's still a labor of love that pays me around $10 an hour. Both your donations and our sponsor ads keep the lights on for Shrink Wrap Radio so that I can continue to provide this huge treasure trove of quality content at no cost to you, unless you choose to become a financial donor or you patronize our sponsors, which I hope you will. And with that, I'm going to wrap it up for today. I want to thank today's guest, Dr. Charles Tauber, for sharing his very challenging and inspiring work on trauma by those experiencing the trauma of war and dislocation. Next week, I'll be interviewing return guest Dr. John Arden about his newest book, Mind, Brain, Gene, Toward the Integration of Psychotherapy. This book is a real groundbreaker. So I hope you'll join us then. And until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.